Warning, some things mentioned in the following discussion might deal with sensitive content. Listener discretion is advised. There's a policeman in Oklahoma behind bars. Daniel Holtzclaw, who was in his 20s, was convicted of being a serial rapist in December 2015 and sentenced to 263 years in prison. But was his conviction fair and just? Syndicated columnist Michelle Malkin of CRTV has written extensively about the unfairness of the conviction. This is Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and Michelle Malkin joins us right now to discuss this case. Michelle, welcome to Vocal Point.
Thanks for having me, Jerry.
Okay, so tell us what happened.
Well, in the summer of 2014, Daniel Holtzclaw was on solo patrol on an overnight shift. He had been a member of the Oklahoma City Police Department force for about 3 years. He is the son of two police officers. His father is still a police officer in the small town of Enid, Oklahoma, and his mother was a police officer in Japan. His parents met in Japan. His father had served in the military, and they've lived all over the world. Daniel is one of three children. He has two older sisters. And he loved his job. He joined to serve and protect. He wanted to honor his father. And this is something that had been a value in the family, serving in law enforcement. And he was very good at his job. Even in the 3 short years that he had served, he had already been promoted to serve a stint in the prestigious gang unit in northeast Oklahoma City. And he was seen as a mentor and role model to some of the younger rookies. It's tough in that neighborhood in northeast Oklahoma City. And one of the things that I think that more Americans are coming to appreciate, especially as law enforcement officers have been literally under fire and ideologically and figuratively as well, certainly under the last 8 years of the Obama administration, is we're realizing how hostile certain cultural forces are to our police. And that certainly isn't new. Of course, in the 1970s, there was an explicit war on police that was declared by a lot of social justice groups, whether it was the Weather Underground or the Black Liberation Army or the Puerto Rican terrorist domestic terrorist group, the FALN. And many cops have died in the line of duty, assassinated by some of these agitators and violent domestic terrorists. I think that context is very important because, as I mentioned, he was patrolling in the summer of 2014, which, as many of your listeners may recall, was a very insightful, with a C, and inflammatory time, Jerry, with the summer of Ferguson going up in flames. And later that fall, of course, we added the Freddie Gray situation, cases where cops were under fire and were involved in police officer shootings that became the subject of a great amount of rioting, agitation, and political exploitation. Well, on June 17th, June 18th, Daniel stopped a 57-year-old woman named Janie Liggins, who was swerving on an intersection high on a hill in northeast Oklahoma City. And this is one of the most gang-infested part of towns, violent, a lot of drug trafficking. And remember that Daniel is patrolling solo and always, of course, on guard and worrying about his own safety. Well, it was the end of his 12 to 14-hour shift, 2 o'clock in the morning, and he pulled her over. There was a 10 to 15-minute traffic stop. There's actually surveillance video of that traffic stop from a surveillance camera located on a building in this rather prominent intersection. Daniel had his flashers on the entire time. We can see that from the surveillance video. And he smelled open beverages that were in her car to see if she had been imbibing any illicit substances. And he talked to her for about, like I said, 10 or 15 minutes, let her go, turned around, and went home. Well, the next day, as he checked in for his shift, he was pulled aside, interrogated for 2 hours, and he discovered during that interrogation, much to his surprise, that this woman, Janie Liggins, had accused him of sexually assaulting her, and it all went downhill from there. But that sets you up for, how this nightmare started.
Hmm. And I understand that apparently all told there were 13 accusers against him. And as my brother, who is the CEO and founder of Creator Syndicate, Rick Newcomb, he wrote an op-ed on this story. And by the way, he's been very inspired by your work on all this. And he said, look, since there were 13 accusers against Officer Holtzclaw, most people just assume he's guilty because where there's smoke, there's fire.
Yes, and I was one of those people who just assumed he was guilty. When he was convicted in December, on December 10th, 2015, I saw the viral video. He became national news because of all of the protesting that occurred around his trial. I assumed he was guilty, too, because of the sheer number of accusers. And it wasn't until the following spring that I was contacted by someone in his hometown who knew his family, who begged me to simply take another look at the story. And, of course, it was somewhat of a third rail, because there had been so much of a social justice clamor that you couldn't even ask the question, what if he didn't do it? I ended up doing a two-part series for an internet broadcasting network that I am a part of called CRTV.com.
Mm-hmm.
And we've made my two-part series free for anybody who wants to watch it on CRTV.com and also on my YouTube channel at Michelle Malkin. And your brother Rick has been such an amazing crusader for the truth, and especially for holding the media accountable. There are so many holes in the stories of these 13 accusers who were procured. That's the only accurate way that I can describe to you, Jerry, that this massive amount of women were collected by the police detectives. And I interviewed those detectives for 2 hours in Oklahoma City to try and get a sense of how they conducted their investigation. One thing that you need to know is just how much tunnel vision and bias these police detectives had in their own supposed search for truth. They admitted to me that as soon as they heard Janie Liggins' allegations, that they automatically believed this woman, even though ultimately there wasn't a single corroborating witness or single piece of direct forensic evidence that backed up any of her story, which was constantly shifting and evolving over time. Everything that Daniel said was consistent. He agreed very early on in his interrogation, which is also available in full for anybody to watch, thanks to his defense team's original private investigator, Brian Bates. You can find that at the website holtzclawtrial.com. But when they lied to him, when the detectives lied to him and said that they had video of him doing untoward things, he said, "No, please show me the video. I didn't do anything wrong." He readily agreed to have his apartment searched and his phone and his computer. He handed over his entire uniform for testing. He opened up his mouth for an oral swab so that they could take a DNA swab. And nothing corroborated Janie Liggins' story, and yet they persisted in believing her over one of their own in the Oklahoma City Police Department. Later, of course, we saw the inflammatory political climate in which this trial occurred. There were Black Lives Matter protesters, both inside and outside the courtroom, intimidating jury members, taking photos of them. There were Black Panthers in full military regalia, menacing these jurors. They mixed it up with them during bathroom breaks in the courthouse. There was chanting that was audible during the whole trial and deliberations of give him life, racist cop, 36 counts, we want life, shouting at the top of their lungs. And the kicker, of course, is that the city of Oklahoma City actually granted a permit for these agitators to violate Daniel's fundamental constitutional rights to a fair trial and an impartial jury.
Should the judge have changed the venue? Should he have moved it to a different place or maybe even recuse himself if he wasn't going to do that?
Absolutely he should. Everyone who I've talked to about this case who has experience with these kind of trials, and there are all sorts of experts in investigations, forensic science, the conduct of these high-profile trials, believes it was a huge, grave error to allow this to continue. And in fact, in Daniel's appeal, he's being represented by a public defender in Oklahoma, they pointed out when the judge, Judge Timothy Henderson, said, well, we're just going to have to admonish the jury to ignore all of the commotion, chaos, and circus mob atmosphere and just have them sort of go on. And the public defender said this is a little bit like tossing a skunk into the courtroom and asking them to ignore the stink, and it certainly stank to heights, for sure.
Wow. All right, we're talking right now with Michelle Malkin. We're talking about the Daniel Holtzclaw case. You can read more at michellemalkin.com. This is a police officer from Oklahoma. Now, going back to this surveillance video that you mentioned, since it sounds like this 57-year-old woman that he pulled over, he's about 27 at this time, I believe, the video from an outside a building, would that show him standing in the car and then her inside her car virtually the whole time, in which case it could help, you know, dispel the idea that there was any kind of sexual favors being asked here?
So enhancing the video would be key, and in fact, there are experts who have suggested this. Unfortunately, Daniel's own defense counsel failed to do this, and strikingly, the video, the surveillance video that was turned over to them by the prosecutors was edited, number one, and was a copy, number two.
Oof.
So it would be very crucial to obtain the full, yeah, unredacted, unedited, original video to do that kind of enhancement. And I have heard from experts already who said that the quality of the surveillance video that is available on YouTube that Brian Bates put up was quite good and quite promising in being able to detect those figures. And I think it's fairly clear after all of the research that I have done, thousands of pages of court transcripts and hours that I have spent with all of the parties involved, that what you'll see is exactly what Daniel described. Another thing that I think is really important, Jerry, too, is to look at all of the inconsistencies and the unreliability of the other accusers. 13 of them went to trial. 5 of them, the jury just determined outright that their stories were so outlandish that Daniel was completely exonerated on those charges. And so what was left was 18 of 36 charges. And as the lead detective told me rather flippantly, Jerry, the jury just decided to, quote, split the baby. This is not how justice in America is supposed to work, and I think it's an indication that this jury simply wanted to get out of Dodge, that they were intimidated, and then they clearly did not make these decisions in a rational manner based on the evidence and facts. Here's a couple of examples. The woman on whose charges Daniel was convicted on the most years, Sherry Ellis, is a woman who described her assailant as a short black man who matched nothing like the description of Daniel Holtzclaw. As I mentioned, he is half Japanese, 6'1", almost 6'2", 240 pounds.
Muscle.
And there it is on videotape in the interview that Sherry Ellis did with police. She was a convicted felon with a very troubled background, and almost all of these accusers had been convicted of very serious crimes, including crimes of deceit. So the prosecution turned this against Daniel by accusing him of being a predator who was preying on the perfect victims. But it's clear after you see how the case was built that for the prosecution and the police detectives, they were the perfect accusers.
Wow. And one thing that I have learned so much from your columns about this, just this whole story, and it was something I was not aware of, and I wanted to have you, you know, explain this in detail, is about DNA. And I'm going to start by saying this. The Bible says that people should be convicted of a crime on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Even our Constitution, by the way, echoes that principle in Article 3, Section 5. Now, today, it's assumed that science has provided an impeccable witness in DNA evidence. But your columns point out that we should be very cautious about that, because sometimes the DNA evidence can be twisted to reveal something different than what actually happened.
Yes. Real life is not like the TV show CSI or these other crime shows where DNA is celebrated as a sort of incontrovertible smoking gun. In fact, as the technology has developed and forensic analysis has become much more advanced and sophisticated, what experts in the field are realizing is just how unreliable this forensic evidence is on its own. It's really just one more piece of the puzzle. But I learned about a phenomenon that has captured the attention of people in this field for the last 10, 15 years called trace DNA or touch DNA. And it's the concept, basically, that we shed up to 400,000 skin cells, epithelial cells, a day. And the kinds of transfers that occur, secondary or tertiary or even quaternary transfers of touching an object and, you know, picking up somebody else's DNA and then transferring it again to a different item or person that the originator of the DNA cells had never even come to contact with, it happens quite often. And there is an entire peer-reviewed scientific literature around cases that had been wrongly adjudged because of the misuse or misinterpretation of DNA. Before I get to the indirect DNA that was found and used in Daniel's case, I want to give you a very famous case of a homeless man in the Silicon Valley area who was charged with the murder of a Silicon Valley mogul hundreds of miles away. Not only was the homeless man never in the same neighborhood area, home vicinity that the murdered man was found, but on the day that of the alleged crime, he had actually been in the hospital. He'd been picked up off the streets by emergency medical technicians who found him drunk in an alley, and so his presence was accounted for 24/7 on the day and night of the murder. Later, it turned out that the DNA evidence, his skin cells, were found underneath the fingernails of the murdered man, got there because the EMTs had put an oxygen monitor on the homeless man, then were called to the scene of the crime hours later, used the same oxygen monitor that transferred the DNA cells to the murdered man.
That is really absolutely fascinating, because you point out that the jury in this Holtzclaw case said it was the DNA evidence that nailed it, as the prosecutor argued in his final argument, and they said, that's it. It's, you know, we... That was it. That was the nail in the coffin for Daniel Holtzclaw.
Correct. And juries tend to put a disproportionate amount of weight on DNA because it has this aura of, scientific conclusiveness. And both the crime lab expert, Elaine Taylor, who works for the Oklahoma City Police Department, and the prosecutor, in this case, Galen Geiger, who tried this case and gave the concluding statement, mischaracterized, I would even say lied to the jury about the nature of transfer and touch DNA, the likelihood that the DNA that was found on Daniel's uniform pants was an innocent transfer, as opposed to falsely and baldly asserting that it could only have come from sexual contact, and then misleading the jury about the actual content of the four small, minuscule samples of skin cell DNA that was found on his pants. Remember that there were 13 accusers, 8 of them Daniel was convicted on, 17 different crime scenes, and yet, so implausibly, the only DNA that was detected and found was from one lone accuser, a 17-year-old, who I believe concocted wild story of being sexually assaulted by Daniel when he had stopped to pull her over. Her mother had reported her for domestic assault. This was a very troubled girl. Took her to the mother's house, talked to her on the porch for several minutes, and then went on his way. It wasn't until months after Janie Liggins had gone public with her charges that this 17-year-old and her mother came into contact with the police and spun their tale of her being sexually assaulted. Daniel had searched her purse, and all of the scientific experts that I've talked to that have seen the actual evidence, the electropherograms, which are the DNA readings, have concluded that the amount of DNA and the nature of the DNA are completely consistent with an innocent transfer, and yet none of this was told to the jury. Instead, facts that were not in evidence were introduced by the prosecutor, and this is the subject of one of the most important propositions of Daniel's direct appeal. Not only did his own defense counsel fail to provide effective counsel in rebutting all of these lies, but then, of course, the prosecutor engaged in a grave amount of prosecutorial misconduct when he was mischaracterizing this evidence.
Going beyond just this particular case, this is really scary because you think about all the people we come in contact with on a regular basis in terms of our skin or whatever. DNA, if it's misused, if DNA evidence is misused, an innocent person could be framed and could possibly be convicted of a crime he or she didn't commit. And this may be very well the case of Daniel Holtzclaw.
I certainly believe it is, and Jerry, that's a very, very important and trenchant point that I've tried to make to people, because even if they, couldn't care one whit about Daniel Holtzclaw and his case or his family, it is quite frightening to think that this could happen to anyone. And in fact, as I mentioned with the Silicon Valley case, it already has.
Yeah.
Touch DNA and transfer DNA was also at the heart of the Amanda Knox case, which is very famous. The American exchange student in Italy who was convicted of murdering her roommate, she and her boyfriend were both convicted, based on transfer DNA that was found on a knife in the kitchen that they shared. And it turned out, of course, that she was completely innocent, and it was thanks to DNA experts with the Innocence Project that the truth finally came out. The bottom line here, of course, is that the mere presence of DNA does not prove a crime happened. It doesn't tell you how or when the material got to its discovered location, and it should never, ever, ever be synonymous for guilt.
Yeah, wow. All right, we're talking right now with Michelle Malkin on Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and Michelle Malkin's website is Michelle with two L's, Malkin, M-A-L-K-I-N, .com. And we're talking about the Daniel Holtzclaw case. Is there a big lawsuit in the works? Was Holtzclaw, in a sense, a sacrificial lamb to maybe try and stave off the social justice mob, if you will?
Yes, I think it's clear from the timeline, from the chaos and the circus mob atmosphere at trial, that city officials and the police chief certainly saw this as a way to throw one of their own under the bus to satiate the mob. And that is what I fear here. We are supposed to live in a country that adheres to law and order and that believes in the constitutional rights of every citizen, and certainly that includes our law enforcement officers who put their lives on the line for our country and for our public safety. And you look at the timeline, you look at the association between the protests that occurred in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, and at the Oklahoma City Capitol, And then every single time when city officials in Oklahoma needed to mollify that mob, making an example of Daniel Holtzclaw. What is this about? Why would women lie? Why would so many of these women lie? Well, they had every incentive to lie, and many of them had criminal records of having lied. These are people who do not believe in thou shalt not bear false witness.
Wow.
And so now many of these women, 12 out of the 13, are being represented by what I consider the new Al Sharpton, a man named Benjamin Crump, who is somewhat of a legal vulture, an ambulance chaser, who has targeted law enforcement officers all across the country. He represented Trayvon Martin's family. He represented Michael Brown's family in Ferguson. And now he's representing these women who are seeking high-dollar payouts from the city of Oklahoma, the police department, and Daniel himself.
Wow, and if Daniel is proven innocent, that would certainly poke holes in their whole ability to get that. Now, I understand 2020 ran a piece on the story, and they reference a dash cam, what the dash cam never saw, and yet your articles point out that Oklahoma police cars didn't even have dash cams at the time in question.
What? Yes, which goes to somewhat of a larger theme that we've seen in political and public life over the last couple of years of fake news. This is textbook fake news. And they've had a year since they originally ran their piece on Daniel's case to correct that glaring error and to incorporate all of the new information, a lot of it which we've been responsible at CRTV for exposing, to incorporate that into their new show. But they reran the piece just a couple of weeks ago without doing that. And your brother Rick did an incredible piece calling on 2020 and ABC to show some journalistic responsibility and ethics, and they failed to do that. I think one of the larger goals in the show that I do, Michelle Malkin Investigates for CRTV.com, is to fill that vacuum and provide a place where real journalism and a single narrative, the truth, is the only thing that we, you know, are dedicated to. And in this case, in Daniel Holtzclaw's case, I am dedicated to following this case and covering it until justice is served and he is free.
Well, now, there's a quote here from Matthew Philbin of Newsbusters. He said, whatever the actual truth in the case, Holtzclaw was tried and convicted in the courts of public opinion. And we have about a minute to wrap up, so why don't you close with that and anything else you want to say to wrap this up?
Yes, I think, again, the larger theme here is about how the so-called progressive social justice mob has hijacked our criminal justice system and has hijacked so much of the public square. Fear and intimidation are their most powerful and potent tools. And it is really, you know, providing light and truth that responsible journalists should do in this case. And Daniel Holtzclaw was naive. You know, people ask me, well, because I visited him many times and interviewed him and his family, what surprised you the most about Daniel Holtzclaw? It was his naivete. His faith in the system, and we cannot simply trust that you can go to a courtroom of law and achieve justice. You also have to fight in the courtroom of public opinion. That's the reality now for so many of these law enforcement officers, and there are a number of trials that will be happening later this spring that will, you know, essentially replicate the kind of conditions that Daniel Holtzclaw had to suffer and endure. So there is a website, HoltzclawTrial.com, for people who want to know more about the case. And then the family runs its own website at FreeDanielHoltzclaw.com and has a petition at Change.org to plead with the governor of Oklahoma, Mary Fallon, to grant clemency in this case. You know, they wouldn't have to wait to go through the entire appeals process, which is winding its way right now. It would take a year, 2 years, who knows. If Governor Mary Fallon would step up and do the right thing, she could grant him clemency tomorrow.
And people can get more information as well at MichelleMalkin.com. Michelle, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it and appreciate everything you do.
Thank you. Same here.
All right. Take care. All the best. Bye-bye.